The following teaching is part four in a six-part series by Dr. Ken Boa, titled, Great Books Everyone Should Know, Series 2.
Many consider that the Divine Comedy is the supreme literary work, not only of medieval Christendom, but perhaps of all the Christian faith. It is a remarkable achievement, perhaps rivaled only by Milton's Paradise Lost, which we've discussed already in an earlier book in this series. And I don't know that any poet has ever come up with a more compelling vision of the soul's journey toward the love of God than has Dante in the Commedia, which he only later called, only after his death was the word Divina added to the word Commedia, which means the divine comedy or the comedy. And it is indeed a drama, as I see it, of the soul's choice. I'm going to be using two translations tonight. The two that I've found to be very helpful are, one is a three-volume edition that has been, the first two volumes were translated and with introductory notes by Dorothy Sayers. She died, unfortunately, before the project was completed, so the last, 12 or 13 cantos were translated by another. And in addition to this series, and her notes are marvelous, and you'll be hearing some quotes from her, the Alan Mendelbaum translation, which came out fairly recently, is a very smooth and very close, very readable translation. It's only about 800 pages long, so you can take a look at that. As I say, this is the drama of the soul's choice. As Dorothy Sayers puts it in her introduction to the first of the series, The Inferno, the ideal way of reading this book, of course, would be to kind of start your way at the beginning and work your way through the order, going from Dante's experience, moving through the various circles of hell, and finally ascending to the Mount Purgatory, and then ultimately to work his way up higher and higher. That would be the nice way to do it. There are 24 great circles of hell, and then you'd go up the two terraces and the seven cornices of Mount Purgatory. And then ultimately you'd go high over the sea and high over the clouds, and eventually you would begin to work your way up toward the heavenly state, moving through one sphere after another sphere until eventually you reach the vision beyond the stars and up to the primum mobile, the first mover, and beyond that to what is called the Empyrean, that timeless, spaceless place. That mysterious place that defies all physical laws, where God himself is beheld in the beatific vision. And his image of the snow-white rose of paradise at the end to consummate the vision of how the saints in joy and in love enjoy the vision of God forever and delight in one another's enjoyment of that vision. It'd be nice to do that. But I'm afraid when you get into this, you get bogged down almost at once. It's so filled with complexities, so filled with images from Dante's own life that are complex personal allusions to figures that are rather obscure. And really, without the knowledge of the historical background, you'd be totally lost. Who's he talking about? Who are these people he's addressing? You have figures not only from Dante's own time, but also figures from the ancient world. He relies a great deal on Ovid and on Virgil. Virgil becomes his guide through hell. Virgil, as we will see, represents what the best of human reason can do, how far reason can take us. And reason can take us as far as the imagery here of moving through the understanding of what hell is like, and even carrying him as his guide in part through purgatory, though Beatrice really becomes his guide, a woman that we'll be describing a little bit later. But reason has its own limits. And as we'll see, it can only carry you so far. It becomes the work of Beatrice herself, this woman who will symbolize, really, the soul's love, who will carry him further up toward that which requires revelation and not merely reason. And so you have this marvelous picture here of a theological, of a political, historical, mythological elements, astronomy, geometry, chronology, all kinds of things, a massive amount of knowledge, all woven together in this epic. And somehow he ties it together in a way that's convincing and powerful. It's a work of intimate personal experience, and few men have ever displayed their own strength and weaknesses really so unreservedly as does Dante, or interpreted the universe so consistently in terms of their own soul's exploration. Because as we're going to be seeing, it's not just the story, but it is, in fact, the allegory that becomes the key to understanding this literature. And it's really, as I say, the drama of the soul's choice. We're talking here about a person who has burning clarity. He's a universal poet, and who focuses on the fact that we are rational beings, we're responsible rational beings, and that the fact is that the Divine Comedy describes not a fairy story, but actually an allegorical picture of the soul's movement, either toward God or away from God. And thus we have a wonderful picture of an architectural grandeur of a poem. Now, the problem would be that when people try to tackle Dante, what do they usually focus on? It's usually just the first volume, if they even read that. And they get all wrapped up in the picturesque squalors of the Inferno, all the gory details, the gruesome movements, and so forth. And it's almost like spending a few days visiting a great city and judging that city by going to its cellars and sewers and telling you what it looked like. If you stop there, you're to miss the whole point. Actually, the poetry, I believe, gets even richer and better as it moves along. And so when people think about Dante, they usually think about these grotesque, Bruegel-like images of people in skewers and people in rivers of blood and so forth. And those are images, really, that when taken in a certain way will cause you to miss the real point of the story, because it's really a journey, as we'll see, upward. It's an extended metaphor. And it combines the vision of the afterlife with the story of the lover. It's a picture here of how you combine both together. What you have here is the vision of hell, followed by purgatory, followed by paradise or heaven. And it's also the story not only of the afterlife, but the story of the lover who has gone on a quest to seek for his lost lady, the image of courtly love, for example, and who goes through one adventure after another through the underworld to find her, and is brought into the combination of those two stories, the mythos of the afterlife combined with the mythos of the quest of a knight errant who was on a pilgrimage to achieve something as a hero. All these images kind of weave together and provide a tremendous image of an allegory as an extended metaphor, images of the way to God. What we have him as is a person who explores the wilderness of his own soul, and he fights against opposition both from without and from within. So it's really an internal journey that is being communicated through the vehicle of an extended allegory that uses images. And these images are really natural symbols, symbols that have a connection with the reality that they're pointing to. And these symbolic images aren't just personified abstractions like wisdom or prudence or science or art or statescraft, but rather these are actual figures of myth, of history, in scripture, and so forth, of Dante's own time, that point beyond themselves as being vivid, living images. It's very difficult to pull off an allegory in the way that John Bunyan did. Very, very unusual to pull that off in a convincing and satisfying way. What Dante instead does is he uses images that become truly alive, not just personified abstractions, but individuals who point in their own character, in their own historical situation or mythology, in the case of allusions to Ovid and to Virgil, they point to certain ways of being and really point to the choice between accepting or rejecting God in the life of the soul. And thus, the literal meaning of this story is the least important part of it. And so to read it just as a story is to miss the real vibrant power that's involved in it. Indeed, there are several levels of interpretation. I'll allude to that a little bit later in a letter that he wrote actually to his own patron in Verona. But in these levels of interpretation, the quest here of the hero is not merely an external quest. Actually, it's an internal quest. Rather than pursuing external glory, he seeks instead spiritual virtues that are to be internalized and to be made real. I'd like to suggest as well that the theme of this book, the unified theme, is amor. It's love. And it is the idea in Dante's thought that people cannot really live without loving. They may think that they can, but they cannot. And his argument is that when we do not love, or when we love the wrong things, or even the right things in the wrong ways, the soul becomes diminished. Because the real search is to love the right things in the right way. And ultimately to discover that the soul's true joy is discovered in the pleasures of the lover of the soul, the one for whom the soul was actually created. There's a kind of cathedral of ideas involved in this book that I think is remarkable. In fact, Dante himself put it this way. He said, "I want to demonstrate truths that no one else has dared to attempt." He was very well aware that this was a virtually transcendent kind of work. He knew that this was his great work, his life's true statement. And being aware of that, both theologically and aesthetically, he knew that he was setting down something that had never existed before, an inimitable work that takes us on this broad terrain of going from the depths and the horrors of hell all the way through purgatory up to the heights of the Empyrean into the presence of the living God. And Dante then really gives us a cathedral of ideas. The architecture of this book is splendid. He combines somehow both scholasticism and mysticism, both the teachers but also the contemplatives. He's combining ancient thought, antiquity, with medieval Christianity, and actually bridging that gap between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance there in Florence. As we'll see, he was born in 1265, and lived to 1321. So he was right on that cusp there, from being a Florentine, right on that cusp between the movement from the medieval synthesis, moving more and more toward a Renaissance vision that became more alive to the classics. And he himself had a good deal to do with that synthesis. He was able to synthesize as well a kind of sacral concept of empire, but also a spiritual concept of the church, and tried to seek how it could be that the two could coexist in a way that had not been done before. A synthesis both of the courtly world and a very different world of scholastic wisdom. And so we see, as the great cathedral builders achieved, a combination of ethics and aesthetics that somehow were able to be integrated coherently and strengthened one another. It's a very rare achievement, and this is a monumental work. I'd like to say a word about Dante's own life and his writings, and a brief word about that. He was born, as I say, in Florence in the year 1265 and belonged to a very a noble but somewhat impoverished family by the time he came on the scene. And he followed a general course of education, probably went to university at Bologna, and received the typical kind of education that you have, the academic trivium, from which we get the word trivia, by the way, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So he studied grammar, as all would do in university, and logic. And these first three consisted of the trivium. And then he went beyond that and also studied the more advanced quadrivium. And the quadrivium, by its name, represents the next four levels, which would be arithmetic, and music, geometry, and astronomy. Theology isn't even included in here because everything was connected in a theological construct, so that theology, the queen of the sciences, was the unifying vision that took philosophy, combined reason and revelation, and provided for us this sevenfold scheme. Dante became a master of these things. But in any case, he also studied poetry, painting, and other areas as well, music, and so forth. So he became a master of these things, and my own guess is that he had a photographic memory because he seems to have a comprehensive knowledge of virtually everything. In fact, he started a work on a book called The Convivia, which means the banquet, which was going to consist of 15 major treatises. He completed four, but it was basically a kind of encyclopedia of all knowledge. He never had a chance to finish it, but just the fact that he'd start such a thing indicates the wealth of his knowledge that he possessed, and you can see that knowledge beautifully illustrated in this work. I'd like to mention one particularly significant moment in his life. It was when he was just about 9 years old, and his father took him to a May Day party at the house of a man named Folco Portinari. And there he met Folco's daughter, Bice Portinari, whom he later called Beatrice. She was about a year younger than him, and it virtually changed his life. It was love at first sight. But it was not the kind of love that you'd ordinarily think of, but it was a love that impassioned, inflamed his soul, and he realized, as he put it, "Behold, a God stronger than I that has come to bear rule over me," and his life was never the same. Some years later, when he was 18, he caught sight of her again, although he'd seen her on various occasions, but in this particular occasion, she was like a revelation to him, her smile, her beauty to him. And of her ineffable courtesy, she acknowledged him and spoke to him by name in the street, the only time she ever spoke to him. Because the next time she saw him, she didn't even address him because some scandalous rumors about him she refused him her salutation. So he learned at that point that love could also be an initiation into suffering as well as ecstasy, as we all have learned one way or another. And the realization, though, that the thing I want to stress, though, is that this particular vision of love became something far more significant than merely puppy love or some kind of a romantic kind of a image that we might have today. It's very hard for us in our culture that has a way somehow moving things down to the lowest common denominator and viewing everything through the sexual orientation to grasp that kind of image of courtly love that existed in the Middle Ages. It's important for us to see that this had something, a bearing on him, that began to point to this a vision of love, a greater love. She died at the age of 24, and sometime after her death, he wrote what was called La Vita Nuova, The New Life, and describing in what he called Il Dolce Stil Nuovo, the sweet new style, which he created to try to express in poetic form that image of love that he had for Beatrice, he tried to create an image of this God-bearing image, the vehicle of glory, a type of all other such communications of grace that she became. For a period, though, he got involved as well in his writing and kind of fell in love with the lady philosophy, so he pursued other lovers in a sort of way. And Beatrice, when she meets him in Purgatorio, chides him for having abandoned that original vision of grace and questing instead after human reason and philosophy, not unlike Boethius in The Consolation of Philosophy, who speaks of philosophy as a woman, as Sophia, and for a period of time was kind of missing his true calling in falling in love with that imagery. He got married when he was about 20 years old and had five children by a woman by the name of Gemma Donati. And his life was somewhat unstable. He made the mistake, I think, in his case, of getting into politics and got rather messed up in the process. Part of the imagery in all three has to do with the trouble in Florence. Italy was a series of city-states and territorial struggles between the papacy and bishops and so forth on the one hand, various clerics, and of various monarchs, various magistrates, various emperors trying to vie for power and kings, and it was quite a mess. There were guild wars going on, all kinds of struggles going on. One of the problems was the division of Florence as a result of the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. And the Guelphs were one party, the Ghibellines another. The Ghibellines had a more open idea toward secular rule. The Guelphs were more interested in a spiritual kind of authority. He found himself within the Guelphs as a leader of the White Guelphs, and when they came out of favor, he found himself exiled from his beloved Florence in 1302, and then later under sentence of death for a trumped-up charge. This under Pope Boniface VIII, whom he did not really care for. In fact, he assigns him a very unpleasant place in hell, though he's not there yet. He's predicting he'll be there soon. And so you have a very strong image here. And people have actually criticized Dante for being particularly nasty to his people he didn't like by assigning him various levels of hell. And so they felt, well, he's rather uncharitable, puts his friends in heaven, puts his enemies in hell. But it's not to be that simple. These are, again, symbols. They're images. They're not to be taken in any literal way. And if you confuse the architecture that we're going to be describing with that reality that he is describing as the soul's journey, you'll miss the point. And indeed, we'll see that really the three put together really cause us to have a greater vision of love and of joy and not just a negative vision. And so I think that those criticisms sometimes are not entirely fair. But as a result of that party split, he was subject to 20 years of exile from 1302 until his death in the year 1321. He never came back to Florence. Though his increasing fame as a result of his writings on the monarchy, for example, and his views and his poetic work led to an invitation among the Florentines to bring him back. It was conditional, and he chose, because of his pride, not to go back. So he roved and went through solitary exile. His wife did not join him. Only many years later, really, did his children join him, when he finally went from one place to another and finally found a place where he could settle down and have more stability in his life. He went to perhaps as far as Paris, maybe studied at the university there. There are some stories during that period of time that he possibly went as far as Oxford, though it doesn't seem that likely that he did. But he studied, and he managed to write, managed to put things together, and somehow, in spite of the chaos of his personal life, managed to create these great works. Probably started on the comedy, probably started somewhere around 1308, and probably finished it really, really not very long before his own death. So it was a good period of time in which he was involved in the writing of this work. He was stripped bare by the end of this period of time, or in the middle, during this time. He'd lost love, lost his youth, lost his earthly goods, lost his household peace and citizenship, lost that vision that he had of active political usefulness, a dream of a decent world and a reign of justice, which he really wanted very much, so much so that he even joined the guild, one of the guilds, so that he could occupy a political office of the priorate there in Florence. He wanted that badly, joined the guild of doctors and of the medical and the apothecary guild. By the way, that's where they sold books in those days, was in drugstores, the apothecary shops. A writer would be connected in that guild as well. And he was stripped bare of all these things. He looked outward upon the corruption of the church, and much of the Divine Comedy criticizes the corruption of the church itself and longs for that time when things would be brought under the authority of God once again, and longed as well for a noble ruler to come, and actually felt that ruler, in his own view, should be a Roman, and should be an emperor, and should be holy. So the idea of a holy Roman Empire, there was one man, Henry VII, that he hoped would fill that role, though he died in 1313 and didn't achieve that, but in this book, he describes him as the possible savior of the world, hoping somehow that Rome was the place that God would use to establish a just reign in a secular realm. And he did not want that to be under the authority of the Pope, but he wanted two separate authorities, one led by God and one also authorized by God, one to provide the secular, one to provide the spiritual, and for them to co-inform one another. So he had his own kind of a view of how these things ought to be, and he communicates that in the process of this book. In his last years, he worked in Verona and then found a patron in Ravenna, And there in Ravenna, he finally found a house, enough stability, some of his children joined him, and there he continued to work. He was sent on a mission as an emissary to Venice. On his way back, he went through a swampy area, contracted a disease, and died sometime shortly after his return to Ravenna. In fact, there's a story about how they did not know where the last 13 of the cantos, out of these 100 cantos, were. And there was a vision, there was a dream that one had about where they would be, and indeed the story goes that, and Boccaccio describes this, where they actually found those, kind of in a musty area in a former house, all these were recovered. The world would have been greatly impoverished if we hadn't had those, because in my view, this work continues to get more exquisite in its poetry the higher we go up in the celestial vision. Well, let's talk about the style of the Divine Comedy, and then I want to give you some images of the architecture and just walk you through some highlights. I can hardly scratch the surface. Basically, my own study of this book made me realize, you know what I really want to do is teach a course on the thing, because it would actually be a wonderful thing to walk you through and just look at and study the images and the incredible literary and historical and philosophical and theological, astronomical, music, all images from all these disciplines, and see how they're so lovely and so how beautifully woven together they are. I can only just give you a sketch of what the structure is about and where it goes. But concerning the intricate structure, it's a poem of almost 15,000 lines or 100 cantos. And a canto, it would be an image of a unit of poetry, and that there are three of these 33 cantos. So it's divided evenly into Inferno, Hell, Purgatorio, Purgatory, and Paradiso. And as we see, there is an additional one canto as a kind of an introductory canto, so that when we add that, we get a total of 100. Numbers were very important to Dante, and the structure of this is such that the symbolism of this symbolized unity and completeness. The number three appears commonly, always standing for the Trinity. The number four, a number for man. The number seven for final unity. And the perfect number 10 are omnipresent. They work throughout. So that, for example, Inferno has 10 primary levels, and so does the purgatory 10, and so does the paradise, and so you have 10 and 10 and 10. And so the combination here of 100 cantos, the square of 10, all these things work together. Each canto ends with a one-line stanza. All three of these sections ends up as well with an allusion to the stars, the very last of each of them. So you have tremendous architecture in this. The style itself, in terms of the form, the rhyme or the meter, it's called terza rima, which means that it would be three. The rhyme scheme would involve three-line stanzas. And so the terza rima, or terzanes, T-E-R, Z-A-I-N. These would be stanzas of three. So you'd have A-B-A, and then the next terzane would be B-C-B, and then you would have C-D-C, and on. So you would take the middle line and rhyme, so there'd be an interlocking rhyme system, and that the last one would be a one line that would rhyme with the last of the middle one of the previous one. So you have this structure that he uses very consistently throughout. He also uses a meter. It's called the hendecasyllable. It's a line of 11 syllables, and it carries 5 accentual beats and rising duple rhythms. So you have a very complex poetic structure that in the Italian scans in such a way that it's very, very difficult for you to translate this, because you're going to compromise your accuracy if you want to have that feeling of the meter and the rhythm of the Italian, or if you try to do it in a more loose translation, then what happens, though it may be more close in the ideas, you lose the feel. So many people have learned Italian just to learn this, just to read this great work, because it's that good. And I haven't done that yet. I have to tell you, it's tempting because of the descriptions of what you get. It's like reading the Greek New Testament. I was forced to learn Greek and Hebrew because in seminary that was a requirement. And I must say, it's like the difference between color and black and white. You get the images all right, but you don't get the nuances. So the translations are reasonable and so forth. You get the picture and you read two or more and you get the sense. But you miss so much still if you don't know the original. And so that would be as well here. There's a grandeur in this book. And the grandeur is such that if you just forget him as the politician or the moralist or the theologian or even as he's been called the most piercing intellect ever granted to the sons of men, and that may be arguable, there remains Dante the poet who walks equal with Homer and Aeschylus and Virgil, his own master, and Shakespeare later. The fact is that it's an impossibility. When Dante chooses to be sheerly beautiful, as he so often does in the Paradiso, he is virtually untranslatable. He writes not like a man, but like an angel, as his translators consistently say. The architectural grandeur of this work is such, the vigor of the narrative, the brilliance of the characterization, a very brisk cut and thrust of the dialogue, all part of that poetry. And it's, again, something that's incommunicable in any other language than Dante's own, say the translators. But he has such varied greatness that even of its fragments, Dorothy Sayers says, you can still take up 12 baskets of the fragments of the beauty of this work. So let's talk a little bit about the sections themselves. As I said, each section ends with the stars. Let me give you an example of that. At the end of the first set of 34 cantos, actually 33 plus one introductory one, which comprises Hell or the Inferno, he just gets through his journey down to the abyss, which we're about to describe very briefly. And as he goes through this process of this journey, he emerges to see once again the stars. So that he says, here it is morning when it's evening there, and he whose hair has served as a ladder is still fixed, because he's actually walked on Satan himself, as you'll see, and then they flip and go upside down and work their way up to the other side of the earth in the imagery here. This was the side on which he fell from heaven. For fear of him, the land that once loomed here made of the sea a veil and rose into our hemisphere. And that land which appears upon this side, perhaps to flee from him, left here this hollow space and hurried upward. So the image we have here, and this is not to scale, is that the opening of this great chasm that comes almost to a point in the center of the earth where Satan is actually dwelling, is then that landmass became this Mount Purgatory. Now, in true scale, then, Mount Purgatory would be something like half the width of the earth, the diameter of the earth, something like over 3,000 miles high, a rather high mountain indeed, and a very giddy climb, because the thing is over 45-degree angle, and the cornices are only about 18 feet wide, and they don't have any parapet at all around them, so it's rather dangerous going, working your way up the way of Mount Purgatory, if the thing is huge. But the idea that we have here is that, as he says, he continued upward, following until I saw through a round opening some of the things of beauty heaven bears. It was from there that we emerged to see once more the stars. And so as he ends Inferno, similarly he ends Paradiso. If, reader, I had ampler space in which to write, I'd sing, though incompletely, that sweet draft for which my thirst was limitless. But since all of the pages predisposed for this, the second canticle, are full, he called each one of these a canticle, so there are three canticles, the curb of art will not let me continue. From that most holy wave I now return to Beatrice, remade as new trees are, renewed when they bring forth new boughs. I was pure and prepared to climb into the stars. So there he's now describing how Beatrice will guide his journey upwards, heading toward the stars. At the very end of the work, in the last canto of Paradiso, he puts it this way. And listen to, again, this is a translation by Alan Mendelbaum. It's very difficult to capture. You could read several of these, and no one of them captures the whole. But he says, in the deep and bright essence of that exalted light, as he's describing the journey, having reached now the highest of the heavens, the Empyrean, the presence of the living God, Three circles appeared to me. They had three different colors, but all of them were of the same dimension. One circle seemed reflected by the second, or as rainbow is by rainbow, and the third seemed fire-breathed equally by these two circles. He's referring to the Trinity in this imagery here. Eternal light, you only dwell within yourself, and only you know you. Self-knowing, self-known, you love and smile upon yourself. That circle which begotten so appeared in you as light reflected when my eyes had watched it with attention for some time, within itself and colored like itself, to me seemed painted with our effigy. He's referring to the sun. So that my sight was set on it completely. So in this final image, he has an image here, this beatific vision. And as the geometer intently seeks to square the circle, but he cannot reach through thought on thought the principle he needs, so I searched that strange sight and wished to see the way in which our human effigy suited the circle and found place in it. How can it be that there's a man in heaven, is what he's describing. How can it be that there's the God-man in this imagery of the Trinitarian vision? And my own wings were too weak for that. But then my mind was struck by light that flashed, and with this light received what it had asked. Here force failed my high fantasy, but my desire and will were moved already, like a wheel revolving uniformly by the love that moves the sun and other stars. Powerful way to end. The love that moves the sun and other stars. The imagery we have, a Ptolemaic image of heaven, is the idea that each of these realms of heaven move together and at the same pace so that they go faster and faster the further out they are. And ultimately, though, the Empyrean is one, though, that is different from all the others. It transcends, as I said earlier, the boundaries of space and time. Let me give you a bit of a survey of the Divine Comedy in the remaining time we have in terms of the actual walking you through the three major sections and just give you a sense of the movement therein. The chronology, by the way, I should point out, is quite intriguing. And most would not guess it from when you read the many descriptions of this, that actually the chronology takes, the whole thing takes place in about a week. It starts off at Eastertide in the year 1300 when Dante is in the middle of his life's journey. As he puts it, he would have been 35, which would be half of his given 70 years, 80 years plus 10, Psalm 90. As for man, his days are but 80 years and 10. If due to strength 80. And he describes this at the very beginning of the first canto. When I had journeyed half of our life's way, 35 years, in 1300, I found myself within a shadowed forest, a dark wood then. For I had lost the path that does not stray. Ah, it is hard to speak of what it was, that savage forest, dense and difficult, which even in recall renews my fear. So bitter death is hardly more severe. I cannot clearly say how I had entered the wood. I was so full of sleep, just at the point where I had abandoned the true path. And so he has this idea that he himself, his soul was in peril because he had abandoned the path that leads to God. And he is brought for various reasons into a realization that his life was heading in the wrong direction. And he's given this vision of hell so that he's capable now of transferring his affections to those true goods that for which the heart was made. The whole thing then takes place. He goes to hell rather quickly. And again, to read this, you wouldn't guess it takes only 24 hours for him to move there. So he starts out on the night of Maundy Thursday when he finds himself astray in the dark wood. And so on the evening of Good Friday, after a day spent vainly endeavoring to scale that mountain, that he meets Virgil, and Virgil then becomes his guide, and they journey through hell, purgatory and heaven, as he journeys his journey. And by the evening of Holy Saturday, these two poets have reached the bottom of hell, at the dead center of the earth. And then they're climbing the long tunnel the next 24 hours, which brings them to the surface again at the foot of Mount Purgatory. So he emerges right at the, and sees the stars right on Easter Sunday. So it's an image here that the soul, it coincides with the soul dying to sin, then buried with Christ on the Good Friday evening, rises with him at the dawn of Easter Sunday. And I think that he certainly had that imagery in mind. And then with this chronology, then spends 3 days and 3 nights in the ascent of Mount Purgatory, and then ultimately completes the journey of that week in his ascent up through the various, through the 10 heavens. I'm not sure why we limit it to seven heaven when we say the seventh heaven, but we do, because really you have ten levels that take place. It reminds me of that cartoon. I'm sure some of you have seen this. I think it's Gary Larson, and it's the idea, or the Cloud Nine. You get that idea, seventh heaven, Cloud Nine. So there's nine levels there. Still not the magic number 10. You've got these people floating around on this one cloud. And they're kind of bored, looking around, watching TV, not knowing what to do. And the subtitle says, Life on Cloud 8. Not quite what it was all cracked up to be. So I mentioned earlier that Dante's universe involved a Ptolemaic system. And in this, then, what you have in a Ptolemaic view of astronomy before the Copernican system is simply this. The way you understand it is that the apparent motions of the heavenly bodies are assumed to be the real motions, which means that the Earth is the center. But not significant. It's the most insignificant place in the cosmos. So it's not a significant place. It happens, though, to be the thing where everything moves around. But if you assume that those apparent motions are their real motions, then you'll grasp the idea of Ptolemaic astronomy. And you'd have the idea as well that beyond these Earth outwards, the spheres of the Moon and Mercury and Venus and the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, of course, they didn't know about Uranus and Neptune and so forth. These hadn't been discovered. Beyond these seven is then the sphere of the fixed stars. And beyond that is the sphere of the first mover, the primum mobile, which is a crystalline heaven that you had. And then this carries no heavenly body, but it moves all the other bodies, so the higher spheres move and animate the lower spheres, so that there's this physical hierarchical system. And so they all move in one daily revolution, 24 hours, their speed increases with their distance from the Earth. And so we have an immeasurable speed then of the primum mobile. But I want you to know that the idea that the Middle Ages believed in a localized temporal kind of heaven, because God goes beyond this, outside of the boundaries, as I say, of space and time. There's neither position nor velocity nor movement nor duration. It's eternal and infinite. So the idea that that these people believe in a localized temporal and material heaven is entirely false, just like Christians don't today. That's a simplistic view. They were far more sophisticated than that. Let's look at the Inferno briefly and see how Dante is lost in this. He starts off in that dark wood. There's an image of a mountain and of these beasts, and these three beasts that, because he starts off at an entry point in what might be called the vestibule of upper hell, as he's going to go into a kind of a vestibule area. This is found in Dorothy Sayers' Penguin edition. It's just an image here. But he starts off in this little vestibule up here. He's trying to actually find the mountain, but he is incapable of doing so. These three beasts block his way. And the three beasts that block his way are the beasts of the image of a leopard, of a lion, and of a wolf. And the leopard symbolizes self-indulgent sins, incontinence, the idea of lust and pride and avarice, respectively. The lion, violent sins, distortions of love, and also the image of the wolf of malicious sins, which involve fraud. And so you have this in this architecture, this picture of hell itself. The gate of hell is probably one of the best known images that you'll know about. This is one of those famous little passages. You know, abandon hell, all you who enter here. It's one of the few things we know about it. This is one of those many books that we know a lot about and no one's read, or very few people have read. But through me the way into the suffering city, through me the way to the eternal pain. So this is the gate here of hell. Through me the way that runs along the lost, among the lost. Justice urged on my high artificer, my maker, was divine authority, the highest wisdom, and the primal love before me, nothing but eternal things were made, and I endure eternally, abandon every hope, who enter here. So this picture here of he moves into the vestibule of the feudal, he moves through each of these journeys, and I'm going to give you a bit of a description of these, a quick description of these nine circles of hell. So allow me to do that, and then I'll bring you back to this. This is a very helpful image here because it gives you the architecture, which is mighty complex, as you go from the earth's surface of the dark forest, the gate of hell, and then you go through this vestibule, working your way down to limbo, which is the place there of the unbaptized dead and also those who went before, like Virgil, who's in limbo. You have an increasing movement, really, toward evil. He kind of picked up the image from Aristotle and Cicero and combined sins, three kinds, sins of incontinence, sins of violence, and sins of fraud or malice. And so as you move from limbo and you move into these divisions, what you have here is a movement where he's has seven levels of hell, but he also adds, in addition to those, the imagery of wrong behavior, which has to do with and wrong belief. Unbelief has to do with limbo, and another level he adds is the level of the heretics, which is the city of Dis. Dis is a name for Pluto, the ruler of the dead. And so we have this powerful sequence of movement further and further down and tighter in. And he complicates matters because what you have here is 10 main divisions, because what you have here are 9 circles in all, and then he adds the vestibule of the futile who have neither faith nor works, and that's not a circle, it bears no numbers, so you have 10 major divisions, but if you add the subdivisions, like Malaboge, which means the bog, evil bogs, and you have 10 of these evil bogs down here, sins of simple malice or fraud, such as the slanderers, seducers, flatterers, simoniacs, sorcerers, barraters. Barraters were people who sold offices and so forth. Hypocrites, thieves. It gets worse. And then you go from simple, and then you go into complex malice, and you deal with people who are traitors. And the worst level of all is finally traitors to their kindred, to their country, to the guests, and to their lords. Guess who's in the lowest level? Judas himself. And so you move your way down into Earth's center. Or another way of putting it, or describing it, is this. You go from upper hell, and these, you move into limbo, the lustful, the gluttons, hoarders, and spendthrifts, and so forth. Sins of in different categories. All distortions of love, of goods. And then from there you move into the city of Dis, the heretics, and then it gets still smaller as you work your way further down into this group here. The sins of the leopard and sins of incontinence, distortions of true loves. And then you move into sins of violence, where they are violence, for example, against God, art, nature, against their neighbors. And as you're working your way in here, you go further down until you hit this great barrier. Past the great barrier, you have what's called the nether hell. And again, I'm not going to go into this in any depth at all, but it's complex stuff. And you move, as I said here, into the Malaboge, these bogs that are covered by, and you go through these little bridges, although one of them is broken, that they have to climb around. And working your way down from thieves, counselors, sowers of discord, falsifiers, and then these giants from antiquity who symbolize human pride. And you're moving really from the sins, and then in the allegory, keep in mind what you're really doing is you're moving from the sins of the flesh to the sins of the spirit. And so you're dealing ultimately with the lowest level, which are the sins of pride and of treachery. And so in the lowest level of all, nether hell, you have traitors to their kindred, country, guests, and their lords. And ultimately Satan is seen in this fabulous image, Cocytus, that I'd like to describe. Charles Williams thought, and I think he's right, it's perhaps the greatest image. Dante, says Charles Williams, scatters phrases on the difference of the place. It's treachery, but it's also cruelty. The traitor is cruel. What you have is a cold and cruel egotism, where Satan is seen as being completely immobile, frozen into immobility, and that is the final state of sin, where it cannot make choices anymore. In other words, you become the choice that you made. You become fixed in your choice. And so in this concept then, what we have here is a portrait of a movement away from the good to that which becomes permanent, where one becomes lost. Continuing into purgatory, we go into this seven-step mountain, although they're really, if you add the anti-purgatory, it's larger than that. So Mount Purgatory, as I said before, this is not to scale, something like 3,000 miles high. And he describes this seven-story mountain, but actually it's more complicated than that because he actually has an anti-purgatory, his own invention. A lot of this is his own invention. An anti-purgatory in which he has people who've been excommunicates, but who actually salvation in articulo mortis, just before they died, that they called out to God and they were delivered. And so these people have to work through a process. I'd like to say a word about that process. First, about the distinction between hell and purgatory, which is an important distinction. In this distinction between hell and purgatory, in hell, in acts of sin produce cumulative effects, the soul remaining at the lowest point of degradation because it's unrepentantly willed to descend to that level. Whereas in purgatory, the sins, we're dealing with the stain of sinfulness, and that stain is being cleansed. So that the penitent soul is shedding off successfully all those imperfections which cling to it against its better will. And so we have the idea of, it's been said that the fire of hell is simply the light of God experienced by those who reject it. And then the imagery of the inferno and also of the purgatory, whether in hell or in purgatory, you get what you want. If this is what you really do want. If you insist on having your own way, you will get it. Hell's the enjoyment of your own way forever. If you really want God's way for you, or your will, you'll get it in heaven. And the pains of purgatory will not deter you, because if you're there, you will get into heaven. This is not a permanent state. All who are there will ultimately find themselves in God's presence. So it must be remembered, for Dante, as for all Catholic Christians, that man is a responsible being. And so this concept, then, of purgatory becomes very important. I'd like to say another word about this concept of purgatory because it has to do really with the idea of cleansing the soul from the stain of sin. And you have three stages in penance. When you think of penance, you confess your sin, then you have contrition where you ask pardon for your sin. When your friend forgives you, right relationship is restored. And so you've purged the culpability, but still the stain of sin is there. And satisfaction and reparation are needed, amendment in yourself. And so in this vision of purgatory, unlike most popular visions of purgatory, it's the purging of the stain of sin. My own view here is that that takes place in 1 Corinthians 3, where the fire, the image of the judgment seat of Christ, purges us from wood, hay, and stubble, the stain of sin. My view here is that it happens, though, quickly rather than over a long period of time. But purged we will be. We must all, who are Christians, stand before what's called the Bema, the judgment seat of Christ, where we will give an account for all the works we have done, and we will be rewarded for those that we have done in His power and through His life in us, and those things of wood, hay, and stubble will be burned away, but we ourselves will be saved, yet so as through fire, is the image in 1 Corinthians 3. So there is that sense of, and if we look at it that way, again, understand the allegorical intention of the idea of purgation would be the way you want to look at it. Thus, because there is hope rather than despair, there is a change, and the poetry is one of delight rather than despondency. And so we have a greater order in purgatory. And in that poetry of delight, we have a freshness, a sparkle, a gaiety, a tenderness, as a journey in hope, kind of a reunion of lovers that had been estranged. God, the lover of your soul, you're being reunited with Him. And you know that point at which you will be, in fact, fulfilled, because you will realize that when that distortion is removed. What you have there, as has been put it, when the soul feels itself free, it becomes free. Because there, as long as there remains in the soul even the least trace of consent to sin, there'll be a clouding and coarsening that remain to fetter the will and the judgment. So that must be all burned away. The imagery there, by the way, of the poetry of delight is illustrated early on in the first canto. For better waters heading with the wind, my ship of genius now shakes out her sail and leaves that ocean of despair behind. Hell. For to the second realm I turn my tale, where human spirits purge themselves and train to leap up into joy celestial. Now from the grave wake poetry again. O sacred muses, I have served so long. So he's now calling for the muse of poetry to animate him, and he's moving now into a whole new dimension. Again, the imagery here is a poetry of delight. And the architecture of this material is that of a born dramatist. A dramatist, his work has all the marks, solid planting and setting of dramatic action, brisk economy in the dialogue and so forth. And so you have a good deal of movement, crispness, and order here. And what you have as well is a very different kind of an image than that which we saw in Hell. The beauty of the material is one where we move in an orderly state rather than something that's disorderly. Hell is chaotic, whereas Purgatory has a picture of order and of symmetry, a higher symmetry. In fact, the trouble he had was to keep Purgatory from being hell in reverse by having the seven deadly sins just the reverse of the other. But in his order, in the architecture, he avoids that problem. And frankly, in that problem of symmetry, typically a poem like this will sag in the middle. As it's been said, the general tendency of long poems is to sag, to become entangled in the middle in their own complexity. What saves the Commedia is its rigid simplicity of outline, the austere functionalism of all its parts, and the passionate intellectual integrity of a man who made it. I see I'm out of time. Well, I didn't time myself very well, and I want to just say some words about Paradise. Perhaps what I'll do is finish up next week, because rather than just rushing in some crazy headlong surge toward heaven, perhaps the wiser course would be for us to finish our journey next week, because there's some wonderful images I want to quote from, some beautiful poetry. Let me pray. Father, we thank you that you have a purpose for us. It is your intention to make us fully conform to the image of your Son. May we long for that. May we trust you in what you take us through in order to bring about that utter satisfaction of becoming the people that you intended us to be all along. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.